This month's featured nutrient at drhoffman.com, EGCG Ultra, bringing you the benefits of green tea in a concentrated form. For all your supplement needs, shop our store at drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's subject is Lyme disease, and we have a very special guest to fill us in on the subject of Lyme disease. He is my good friend and colleague, Dr. Leo Galland. He's been a previous guest here on Intelligent Medicine. And Dr. Galland, for those of you who are not yet familiar with him, is someone who is very worthwhile following. He writes a column in the Huffington Post. He's also author of three highly acclaimed popular books, which I recommend: The Fat Resistance Diet, Power Healing, and if you've got kids, Super Immunity for Kids is a fantastic book. He's a board-certified internist. His medical school training is at Harvard, and then postgraduate training at New York University School of Medicine. And he has also authored dozens of scientific articles and textbook chapters. He is in practice in New York City. And I must say, on a personal note, I've known Leo Galland for, well, nearly 30 years. And he is always at the forefront of developments in integrated medicine. When the yeast connection was just becoming part of our consciousness, he was one of the first to understand it and popularize it. When subjects like the importance of essential fatty acids were just coming into prominence, he was right there at the beginning. Magnesium is something that he helped to propel into the mainstream of modern scientific thinking and medicine. And when you talk about dysbiosis and the leaky gut syndrome, the importance of the microbiome, many decades ago, he was a leader in pointing out the importance of that. And so without further ado, Dr. Galland is here to tell us about Lyme disease, which he's now focusing his attention on. So it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine, Leo, once again.
Hey, it's great to be here with you today, Ron.
And so lately, you have been really drilling down on the problem of Lyme disease. Lyme disease, of course, is not a new problem, but it's poorly understood. And you just posted an article in the Huffington Post, and you're about to conduct a free webinar on the subject of Lyme disease, which we want to call to the attention of the public.
Great. I really appreciate you doing that. It's such an important topic, and really is increasing in the impact that it has on the health of people in this country. With regard to a medical practice, it's kind of like an invasive species. You know, once you start to recognize Lyme disease and the many ways in which it's making people ill, the more and more Lyme begins to occupy your clinical attention. I mean, and there are probably days when half the people I see have chronic Lyme disease.
Well, that's fascinating because, you know, you have a practice where you specialize in seeing patients who are very challenging. Many of the patients who come to see you have been to many doctors, not to mention even complementary physicians. They've tried, you know, the usual healthy diets, vitamins, supplements, detoxification, and yet they can't get well. And you've actually found that an obstacle to their attaining wellness is that they were improperly diagnosed, that they actually had Lyme disease or a related infection.
Oh, yeah. Over and over again, if we just take conditions like chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, you know, a good half of the patients that I see who've been given those diagnoses have Lyme disease. Now, I'm in New York. There's possibly more Lyme in the Northeast than in the rest of the country, although it is spreading widely across, it is spreading across the country. And I've a colleague in Colorado who sees Lyme disease all the time. He said the idea that there's no Lyme in the mountain states or the Southwest is totally wrong.
So just because there's no deer, or if you're not living in a wooded area, or perhaps you live in California, you know, someplace which is so far removed from the Northeast, which is the epicenter of Lyme disease, doesn't mean that you can't have Lyme disease or related infection, correct?
Yeah. And they're different, absolutely, and they're different species of the organism Borrelia that you may encounter in California than you do in the Northeast. They've been finding infected deer ticks in the prairies. It's not just about the woods. And deer are not really the essential reservoir. And, you know, when we talk about a tick-borne infection, the human being is the host for the infection. The tick that spreads the infection is the vector. And then the animal in the that carries the tick, it represents the reservoir. And deer are only one reservoir, and they're able to survive because they don't get Lyme disease. Neither do cows, neither do horses. And probably any of those large mammals could be a reservoir for the ticks that carry the Lyme organism. Now, most cases are spread by deer ticks, but not exclusively. There have been some studies from... There's a study from South Florida which looked at the... looked at a bunch of patients with chronic fatigue and found evidence of Borrelia infections in a significant percentage of them. Maybe it was 50%. And they actually identified two unique new species of Borrelia. One was Borrelia americanus, but they did have a couple of people with classic Lyme Borrelia, which is Borrelia burgdorferi.
Now, are these going to be picked up on the standard tests? Because this is part of the problem.
Well, they won't be.
Yep.
See, they'll give you false negative Western blots.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I had a patient from the West Coast who had a positive culture for Borrelia, indicating that there was something in her blood, but all of her blood tests for Borrelia burgdorferi were negative. And that's the standard Lyme organism. However, she tested positive for a different species, Borrelia hermsii, that for which there's not a Western blot, just a standard ELISA test, and that's one that's found on the West Coast, but it's been moving east.
So what we can say about the tests is that the tests don't give us a very accurate read, that we might get a lot of false negatives. Conversely, can we get false positives, people where we might suspect Lyme, where, you know, we bombard them with antibiotics and it's actually an exercise in futility?
Well, yes, you can clearly get false positives as well as false negatives. The reasons for false positives would be... twofold, I think. One, the most common is that someone has had Lyme disease before and they still have antibodies, but they're not still infected. And the other reason is that they have some kind of autoimmune disease that's creating false positives.
Which is sort of spinning off like a lot of antibodies, such as we might see, you know, perhaps viral antibodies in someone who's just generally sick, and the viral antibodies are high, but it's not necessarily one or another virus that's the specific cause
right.
of the disease.
Right.
Okay.
So it's possible. And, you know, just there are people walking around who may never have known they were exposed to Lyme disease who have antibodies. They may not still be infected. I mean, this is really a very difficult decision, and I will try to talk about the process of thinking through treatment decisions in the two webinars that I'm doing.
Yeah, tell us about the details on the webinars, because obviously, and this is sort of a, for our listening audience today, this is sort of a, an appetizer for going into greater depth on the subject of Lyme disease, and it's a really great opportunity for you to become up to speed on some of the latest thinking on this complex and challenging disorder. So, give us the details on how people can participate.
Okay, well, you can sign up for the webinar. There's no charge. And probably the easiest way to do it is to go to the website pilladvise.com. That's pilladvise.com. Find the blog about Lyme disease and click through and just register. Or you can go to the Huffington Post article, which is up on the front page of the Healthy Living section under featured blogs, and you know, and click through to the same way. The you can participate in the webinar live on Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. There will be call-ins.
That's Wednesday the 11th. That's the 11th of June, correct?
Yeah, June 11th.
Okay. What about if for people who are some people may be listening to this podcast after the fact, they may be dialing
you
back.
Can,
so can they still retrieve the webinar?
I'm sorry. Yeah, the second one is going to be on June 25th.
Okay.
Which is also Wednesday evening. But and one of the main values to participating live is that you can call in and ask questions. But otherwise, it'll be archived. It'll be up online, and you'll be able to download it at any time and listen to whatever parts of it are of interest to you.
You mentioned Pill Advised, which is also a fantastic resource for patients, and you have a great newsletter. You can sign up for it. I believe that there are already over 30,000 subscribers to Pill Advised. And what is Pill Advised precisely?
Well, it's a site that actually is run by my son, Jonathan, which offers information about integrative medicine and nutritional and environmental health. There are reviews of recent articles. There were articles by experts in the field, including you, Ron.
Right. We actually share that because you're a contributing columnist at drhoffman.com as well, so we reciprocate.
Right. And I mean, the information that you have, and it really complements the information that I put forward. So it's great to be able to share that with people.
And Pill Advice also has an interesting feature which enables people to check for interactions between the supplements they take and medications. Is that correct?
Right. That was the original software that was created for Pill Advice, which looks at interactions between drugs and supplements, drugs and food, and also between supplements and supplements. And the database is based upon about 1,000 hours of research that I did, pulling together articles from the medical literature, making a concise summary of the article, and always going back and checking the original references.
Right. So this is a very authoritative way to find out if the stuff you're taking is compatible, you know, because there is a potential for interactions, there are helpful enhancements as well. And I think you can point that out as well, is it's there's not always a harmful interaction. There's often a augmentation of the benefits of a medication or a supplement via the use of something else.
Right. That was something I found really interesting and useful as I was creating the database. And what I especially noted was that there was more data and a greater number of beneficial interactions than harmful interactions. The harmful interactions were all kind of anecdotal, you know, case reports, whereas the benefits were all based upon controlled studies. So I'm actually, a higher level of scientific proof.
Yeah, I'm actually writing an article about how to counteract some of the arguments of vitamin naysayers. That'll be in my newsletter this week. And one of the arguments is, well, if you take a supplement, you're likely to mess up the efficacy of one or another medication you're taking. And your research has led you to believe that, yes, that may be the case sometimes. But more often than not, there is no interaction, and there actually may be a synergy, a helpful synergy.
Right, and the synergy is something that's been studied, you know, scientifically. It's not just a report of, in other words, no one would accept a report that says, oh, I started taking magnesium and my blood pressure was well controlled as a single case. But if somebody was taking magnesium and their blood pressure went up,
they would get an article published in a medical journal.
Right. Yeah,
right.
So basically, to get back to the Lyme webinar, there are going to be two webinars, and the first one is going to be an overview of the epidemic of Lyme disease that is really sweeping this country. And it will talk about the signs and symptoms and how the diagnosis is made. I just want to give you some information about the frequency, and there are two studies that I've seen really recently that actually kind of blew me away, because as a clinician, you know, I just see, and we see the people that come into our office, and of course they're mostly patients that have been to other doctors. They haven't gotten the help that they wanted to get, and so we see a kind of select population of people who are chronically ill. And when you look at the research that's being done on Lyme disease, you realize that there are a lot of people. There are way more people in that situation in this country with regard to Lyme disease than I had appreciated, based upon the fact that I figured, well, I'm seeing, you know, this select population of chronically ill people, and I'll just give you that. These two references. The first is a study that has just been done by the CDC and the Infectious Disease Society of America. And, you know, in the Lyme disease, the Lyme patient world, the Infectious Disease Society of America are the bad guys that are saying, well, you know, you only need 3 weeks of doxycycline and you're cured.
They're the chronic Lyme disease naysayers.
Yes, right. Well, nonetheless, they commissioned this study, and it seems that there are about 3.5 million tests of Lyme antibodies done every year in the United States, and something like 12.5% of them are positive. And so the people who were doing the study concluded that that actually there may be as many as 400,000 cases of Lyme disease a year in the U.S. Now, the CDC had previously said that there may be as many as 300,000 from interviewing doctors and pharmacists. And, you know, there are only about 30,000 cases reported to state health departments.
Wow. That's a huge discrepancy, yeah.
Yeah, right. Everybody knew that there was massive underreporting. And there were many of us who thought that 300,000 was a pretty reasonable number. The CDC came to the same conclusion. Now, of course, that's only the people who are actually being treated for Lyme disease, because there is some unknown number who get infected and aren't being treated.
And you don't have the standard test positive.
Right, right. And so, you know, I mean, it's possible the 300,000 number is a lowball figure, and even 400,000 a year may be a lowball figure. And those figures are incidence rather than prevalence. And just to explain the difference, incidence is the appearance of a new case.
Mm-hmm.
Prevalence is kind of the number of total cases.
Right. It's sort of like, you know, how many people are getting on the Long Island Expressway, not how many people are on the Long Island Expressway.
Right, right. So, and, you know, it's based upon the notion that that this is an acute illness rather than a chronic illness.
Wow.
I mean, that's kind of how they arrive at that. So if you take 300 or 400,000 a year, I mean, in a decade, that's 3 or 4 million people. In two decades, that could be 8 million people. So there are, based upon this data, there are millions of people in the U.S. who have been infected with Lyme disease. And then there's this very interesting study from Johns Hopkins that was published a couple of years ago. There's a big question about, okay, well, what happens to people who are treated for Lyme disease? And, you know, the Gary Wormser, the president of the Infectious Disease Society of America, had said, well, current guidelines work for 96% of these patients. The current guidelines are you do this two-tiered testing, first an ELISA and then a Western blot, and if it's positive, you treat them with antibiotics for three weeks, and that's it. Well, if there's a false percent failure rate, and let's say 10 million people have gotten infected with Lyme disease, I mean, that's many tens of thousands of people for whom the standard approach has failed.
But, of course, that 96% figure is overly optimistic.
Right, right. And above and beyond, even if you could accept it, even if that were a correct figure, there's still, you know, a few hundred thousand people walking around in this country who have been inadequately treated for Lyme disease and whom those, in whom that approach did not work. Now, there was a study done at Hopkins which was a really unusual and a very good study because it was a prospective study. That is, it took a group of patients who came in with definite acute Lyme disease. They had the rash, they had fever and chills, they had, everybody treating them agreed these people have acute Lyme disease, early Lyme disease. And they were treated with standard antibiotic therapy. And then they checked on them 6 months later. Well, 6 months later, 35% of them had developed symptoms that they didn't have before they got sick with Lyme disease.
So something is going on there. What are some of those symptoms?
Right. These included fatigue, pain, and neurocognitive dysfunction, you know, brain fog and mm-hmm. memory problems. And the people who were complaining of those new symptoms had a significant impairment of life functioning compared to the people who had not developed those new symptoms. So, I mean, if you use those statistics, then the treatment approach of the IDSA is only 65% effective.
This is a good inflection point for us to take a pause because we're going to split this podcast into two parts. Part one, defining the problem, Lyme disease. And in our discussion today with Dr. Leo Galland, we're going to resume and we're going to talk about how you can determine if you might be among those who are sort of left high and dry vis-a-vis a Lyme diagnosis, what to look for, what are some of the possibilities, and also we'll provide you with some insight on a new upcoming webinar by today's guest, Dr. Leo Galland. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.